now ask our three commentators to keep their remarks to 5 minutes. Following the remarks, I will ask Professor Sassoli if he wants to respond to these remarks. Following your intervention, we will open up the discussion. We will have a Q&A period. And there are two microphones in the audience, so you will be more than welcome to ask your questions. Thank you. So now we will turn to Arthur Onik for a brief remark. Thank you.
Good morning. First, let me start and say that it's a great original idea. It's truly timely after the Goldstone report on the Gaza war. I'll focus my comments on what I consider to be the main problem with this, and that is the internal political dynamics that will result from introducing such a law. I argue that the unintended consequence of these armed groups adopting some code of IHL is a radicalization process. What I believe is expected to happen is that once the more relatively moderate leaders of this armed group adopt this, tie their hands and adopt some kind of formal obligation to engage only in sabotage, let's say, they show their moderate colors. And as a result, the more radical members of the group will position themselves in a better situation politically and will basically attack politically the more moderate leaders. So you're narrowing the political room for maneuver of these relatively moderate leaders who do need the ability to make empty belligerent rhetoric. So that's what I consider to be the main problem, the splintering that is about to happen. And that's a real problem in terms of conflict resolution, because in the end of the day, we want to have the government sitting and talking to a responsible insurgent group that actually controls the insurgent movement, the whole insurgent movement, or at least the majority of it. And once we encourage splintering, we actually do not promote conflict resolution. Now, this splintering, I argue, is a very rational response, because it's a matter of strategic behavior on the part of the political actors within the insurgent movement. They want to bid for leadership, and so they position themselves in a radical position, because you just provided ammunition for them to attack the relatively moderate leaders. In the real world, that's why we see oftentimes, in terms of selection effects, we see that a lot of groups do not choose to bind themselves, precisely for that reason. The only case I can think of a group that decided to bind itself formally was perhaps the ANC that signed the Geneva Conventions. But mostly leaders, you know, if they wanted to formally bind themselves, would find means to formally bind themselves. They have chosen not to, precisely for those internal political dynamics reasons. I'll be brief and say that, to conclude, the armed group is not a unitary actor. The insurgent movement is not a unitary actor. And the problem is not a problem of command and control, as you pointed out. That, you know, we want to help, yes, I want to help the commander of the armed group to discipline his members and subordinates and so on. The problem is a problem of strategic behavior, and not of command and control. And so I would like to ask you, it's really an open question, because I'm just speculating what will happen. I don't really know how the introduction of such laws will actually influence the internal political dynamics within the insurgent movements and within the armed groups themselves, but I would like to ask you to comment on that, Professor Sassoli. Okay, that's about it. So basically my point is the insurgent movement is not a unitary actor, so is the armed group is not a unitary actor, and it's not a problem of command and control. And we must think of the internal political dynamics, because these leaders think about, first and foremost, their constituency as political actors. And commanders of insurgent groups are primarily political actors bidding for leadership of the whole insurgent national liberation movement. Thank you very much.
Well, good morning. First thing I'd like to do is to thank Jonathan, of course, for chairing the panel, but most of all, thank you. And the reason I'd like to thank you is, as a former counterinsurgent, I guess it's still an active counterinsurgent, and as a representative of Canada's military, while you may or may not agree with the mission in Afghanistan, what's clear to us who wear the uniform is that we have the support of the Canadian people. So I just thought I'd take this little time to put out a paid advertisement and thank you for the support that we receive from you. I'll preface my comments by pointing out that I'm neither a lawyer nor an academic. I studied mechanical engineering, and when I found out I couldn't do math, I became an infantry officer. So these points are going to be pretty simple, and they may not, I'm hoping they don't appear shallow, but take them for what they're worth. First of all, when I look at a proposal like this, if I'm either an insurgent or a counterinsurgent, the first question I'm going to ask is, what's in it for me? And the answer to that is basically why anyone would follow international humanitarian law or the laws of armed conflict. And really, what it boils down to, from my point of view, is legitimacy. If you want to have legitimacy as a democratic state actor, or in some cases even as a non-democratic state actor, you rule, to a greater or lesser extent, by consent. And you won't have consent unless you follow the rules. It's really as simple as that from my standpoint. And consent, which demands adherence to international and all law, is really, if you don't have it, the consequences are essentially you end up in court, in front of a tribunal or whatever it happens to be, or if you're a government, you get voted out or you get turfed out. From an insurgent standpoint, they really don't have any such limitation because they don't rule, in most cases, by consent. Rather, they rule through intimidation or repression. However, we do know there are insurgencies that enjoy a good deal of popular support, and it is those insurgencies that I believe that would be more likely to employ what we would call consent-winning tactics. And in those cases, you may find that your proposal would have traction. From a counterinsurgent standpoint, so from our standpoint, from the government standpoint, some will say that we're out there to defeat the insurgents and that it's a largely military operation. Others would describe it as an effort to win hearts and minds. In other words, you drain the swamp rather than killing the individual mosquitoes. And in the case of Prince Edward Island, that would be cutting the bridge. So I already gamed that out while you were up here, sir. But to my mind, counterinsurgency operations are about removing the word armed from armed opposition. If that group becomes just the opposition, then they're forced into the political process, then they have to go back to the population to win consent. Once they've got to go back to the population to win consent, then they're forced down the path that we've heard here, and the consequence is they have to follow international humanitarian law. So in essence, what we do as counterinsurgents is empower the people, protect the people, empower the people, and force the insurgents to become just the opposition. So I would sum up just by saying that in approaching these insurgent groups, one has to be a bit practical. There are, I think, good insurgents and bad insurgents, and I wouldn't want to be the guy who had to wander into the Taliban's camp and pitch this to them. Thank you very much.
Good morning. I'm going to take a slightly different take, and I'm going to look at this from the perspective of a political scientist who studied insurgents for most of her academic life. And instead of directly addressing the proposal that Marco put before us, I want to take it as a stepping stone to think about broader issues that address not only this panel, but its relationship with other panels. In the written comments that Marco made, there was something that was not as much emphasized when he spoke, and it's the fact that labeling matters. Labeling matters, and it matters deeply. And while there is clearly a legality gap between state and non-state actors, this is also actually deepened by a legitimacy gap, especially when it comes to the perceptions of international actors. Someone who doesn't know much about an insurgency will usually think that the government at least has the legality and therefore must be a little bit more legitimate. In other words, insurgents have to really face this issue. And the use and abuse of labels is increasingly a problem in places where governments have used the label terrorism, especially since 2001, to try and ostracize their insurgent opponents. And I think that I want to take this as a starting point to ask, you know, when they are armed, armed oppositions are often armed because they couldn't do it otherwise. And I think that is something that we all collectively need to really think about. That is not always the case, but that is often the case. In other words, taking for granted the fact that because the government is in power, it necessarily represents the good guys. And that is something that we did in various places, and I don't want to go back into the way in which the international community dealt with a number of insurgencies over the years, but that has led in many places to peace agreements that were signed with the wrong people and did not really have the rootedness to last. The second comment I want to make has to do with differentiating different types of insurgents. Marco, in his comments, says there's a difference between people who hold territory and people who don't. I think that there are other types of differences that have to do with the degree to which groups are institutionalized, the degree to which they are only military or actually span other types of dimensions. There are groups that are very highly politicized. There are groups that have a very extensive network of social services. And all of this matters. It matters in terms of points of contact. It matters in terms of trying, you know, to play on some of the objectives of these groups that might not all go in the same direction, and we know that not all good things go together. And it matters also because it allows us to think about what I would consider to be out-of-the-box ways to engage these groups. Sometimes you cannot engage them on issues of politics, but you can engage them on issues of economy. That's what we've done with the whole regime of sanctions, for example, in many cases in Africa. In other words, what I want to do, and I don't have time to elaborate, is suggest that there are differences that matter beyond simply the issue of what type of strategies the group use and what their ideology is. We need to look seriously at their structure. We need to look at their economic bases. We need to look at the way in which they are or are not embedded in the populations that they control and reign over. We also need to think that groups evolve and change and that what we do might actually push them either in the right or in the wrong direction. And that gets me to my third and almost last point. I have another one. I know Jonathan told me he was going to be a very stern chair, is how to make insurgents accountable. And what I've heard is the need to have credible outside interventions. Marco makes it very clear that you cannot call a group one day a terrorist and the second day an insurgent and then go back, because groups see what's happening around the world and they learn from each other's and from each other, and governments do learn from each other. I think there is another dimension we need to bring to the table, which is the role of populations. Too often, we tend to think of the populations caught in civil wars as vulnerable, agentless populations. But the populations are not agentless. In fact, there is a lot of very good political anthropology work that actually looks at the way in which people, even in the most dire situations, can organize and actually start engaging in dialogue with the people who are presumably ruling over them by fear. And that, I think, is the kind of stuff that we need to, that's the new frontier of political science. If the new frontier of law is what Marco proposed, this is the new frontier of political science when it comes to the study of insurgents. We have not done enough about this, and this is where I think we need to go. And then finally, how to reward or not reward compliance. The dilemma, I think, was clear. If insurgents comply, even though outsiders might want to reward them, that goes against the grain of what governments often want to achieve. Governments want to strip insurgents of legitimacy. Very often, they're not interested in actually compromising. And so we need to weigh in on governments as well. We need to go back to that whole point that I started with, which is that often taking up arms is because there were no other solutions. And I think that this is important not just for us to instrumentally get some sort of, like, you know, stability and disarming of oppositions, but because otherwise the fairness and equity issues will undermine the authority and the moral authority of international humanitarian law. And that, to me, is a very, very scary prospect. Thank you.
First of all, thank you very much for these comments. Sorry that someone has been
just playing a game of musical chairs.
It's a Canadian thing. Sorry, perhaps I should speak from there. So you can.
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. I will be short. First to say that I agree with everything Marie-Joëlle Zahar said, and the different, just to explain, the differentiations I make is about to determine the applicable law, while those she makes are indeed very important to get the respect to enforce. And indeed, we must know our enemies, which in my view is one additional argument why to engage them, because then you know more about them. For all the three commentators, I should stress that what I said is not my proposal, it's the existing law. It's uncontroversial that insurgents, if it is an armed conflict, and we have perhaps to discuss what is an armed conflict, but if it is an armed conflict, and Afghanistan, sorry, I'm very happy to be in Canada, because in Germany they seriously say it's not an armed conflict. There I would have a hard moment now. I'm happy to be in Canada where you don't say that this is a love affair, but it's an armed conflict with the Taliban. Okay, so if it is an armed conflict, both sides are bound by these rules. The issue is simply how do we get the insurgents to respect it, and let's a little check whether the rules are realistic. Now, the internal political dynamics. First, I must say simply, 39 armed groups have made a deed of commitment of Geneva Call. Okay, it's only on anti-personnel landmines, and I agree that probably if we had torture, detention, and so on, we would come into more difficult things. We are working on that. I can't promise that it will work within the next years, because for us the important thing is we must, as Geneva Call, be credible, which means we cannot accept commitments which we are not able to monitor. But the ICSE works on a much larger panoply of issues, and it is from the very beginning obvious that the ICSE works as much with the insurgents than with government. Now, the internal tension within the group, that's indeed an issue. And one has to make sure that one gets representative people, and not simply the representative in Europe or in Canada, but the actual commanders. And in Geneva Call, we insist we want the commanders. Fortunately, the Swiss government gives visas to those commanders to come to Geneva. And then, okay, there's a risk of internal tension. But as I said, I'm not a fanatic of armed groups. I don't care if they have internal tension. Even better, if some people, hopefully the majority within the armed group, are against those who do not want to respect any rules, rather than to have the whole group not respecting any rules. And I think it's in the interest of every group to be organized and disciplined, and that's the starting point for the respect of humanitarian law. By the way, thinking about my past in the International Committee of the Red Cross, I was thinking a lot of what you were saying describes very well also states. when I negotiated with states, there were always some people who were very much in favor of humanitarian law and others not. And there were questions of internal tensions and so on. And states, is there any state, I don't say state, is there any government in the world which doesn't think first and foremost of political interest? We must simply obtain that they understand that it's in their political interest to respect some rules. And I fully agree with you, General, that it's a question of legitimacy. Simply, I would say that many armed groups, perhaps more than you would admit, fight also for legitimacy. There are very few groups which absolutely do not care what the population says. I would even call these not really insurgency. If it is simply to loot the country and they don't care absolutely of what the people think, then I agree with you, such engagement of the group is nearly hopeless. I would nevertheless try it and simply give them the ball that they don't want it. While if I make differentiations, then I get the problem with the government. So you have understood that I'm very much with General McChrystal. And as far as you mentioned the Taliban, I must tell you, I don't know the details, but the ICC has longstanding, clear contacts with the Taliban to get the respect of humanitarian rules from them, and it negotiates such issues with the Taliban, and I think it's essential for their mandate, because if it was working only on one side, in my view, you don't need an ICC to work only on one side. The added value is that it is on both sides, and so it must always try to.
Okay, well, thank you very much. If I should say first that if you would like...